It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Today could be the biggest day of the Vancouver Winter Olympics for the U.S. alpine skiing star, and the Olympic Games don't even start till tomorrow. Lindsey Vonn is hoping to take part in a morning training run as a way to test out her injured right leg. Her injury became huge news yesterday when she announced it may be too painful for her to compete in the Olympics. And it was an Olympics in which Lindsey Vonn was pegged as one of the biggest stars. Joining us this morning from Whistler in British Columbia is NPR's Tom Goldman. Good morning.
Hi, Renee.
It sounds like the news of her injury is causing quite an uproar.
Yeah, it really is. Imagine several days before the 2008 Beijing Summer Olympics began and Michael Phelps announced he might not swim at all. Vonn is Vancouver's Michael Phelps, even though she hates the comparison. She's the alpine queen in waiting. She's projected to win multiple medals, including gold. This is her third Olympics. She's never won medals. She was in top form before the injury, and this was her time.
And the question, obviously, is it still her time?
She didn't sound optimistic. She said she had a badly bruised right shin. It was the result of a slalom training accident in Austria last week. She said she hadn't skied since the crash. And when she simply tried to put on a ski boot this week, it was, in her words, excruciating.
This is definitely the most painful injury I've ever had. You know, like this year when I crashed and I hurt my wrist, it's not as hard to ski with a wrist injury as it is to ski with a shin injury. So it's going to be very, very challenging and very difficult, and I think it's going to be hard.
Now, she stayed in Austria after the injury and used a little home country remedy. She said she covered her leg in Austrian Topfen cheese. It's often defined as curd cheese. It apparently has anti-swelling healing properties. Her doctor, an orthopedic surgeon named Bill Sterrett, he said yesterday, a lot of athletes have tried it with good results, although there was a fair amount of joking about the cheesy remedy.
Okay, but what did the doctor say about what, in fact, is and will be her condition?
Well, you know, this is where the outlook got a little brighter. Later in the day, after Vonn's announcement, Dr. Sterrett spoke on a teleconference, and he said she's on the mend. He said he was joking with Lindsey Tuesday night, and he asked her how much better she was than last week.
She said 62, and then she said, no, 62.5% better. And I think she's better today than she was before. I think she's well on her way to looking very good for these Olympics.
Now, part of his optimism is because he knows how tough she is. Vonn has a history of overcoming bad injuries, including a terrifying spill 2 days before the last Winter Games in 2006. Amazingly, she came back and raced in those games, even though she was badly bruised and sore. This injury, as you've heard, Renee, really hurts. But Dr. Sterrett said it's a muscle bruise and not a broken bone, as some had speculated about yesterday. She is day-to-day. Sunday is the first of five events in which she's scheduled to race.
Now, Lindsey Vonn has been projected to be the big name of these games. 4 years ago, there was another American alpine skier destined for megastardom, and that was Bodie Miller. The big medal haul didn't happen. He is back. So tell us what he had to say yesterday.
Well, yeah, he's an interesting guy. He's the great iconoclast, of course. He grew up in a cabin in the woods in New Hampshire with no electricity or indoor plumbing. He won two silver medals at the Olympics in 2002 and, as you say, went into the 2006 games with huge expectations and then didn't race well. He was remembered more for his comment that he partied at an Olympic level. And whether you call him an iconoclast or just insolent, he was feisty at times yesterday with reporters. And it'll be really interesting to see how Bodie Miller, without the huge expectations, performs this time around.
Tom, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
NPR's Tom Goldman speaking to us from Whistler in British Columbia, Canada, on the eve of the Winter Olympic Games.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris. It's fair to say, at least officially, that a mental disorder does not exist until it's in the DSM. That's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It is the Bible of psychiatry, and it describes all the different mental disorders recognized by modern psychiatrists and insurance companies. Today, after almost a decade of work, the American Psychiatric Association released a list of disorders that it intends to publish in the next DSM. There will be some big changes, specifically when it comes to kids with what's known as bipolar disorder. The number of kids diagnosed as bipolar has been growing exponentially in recent years. But as NPR's Elise Spiegel reports, the people behind the new DSM hope to change that.
The number of kids diagnosed as bipolar has rapidly increased. One study found that kids today are 40 times more likely to be diagnosed with bipolar than they were in 1994. And over a million kids are now treated for the disorder with heavy-duty medications. One of those kids, an 11-year-old named Jacob, woke from sleep one morning last week and found his mother cheerfully waving a borrowed microphone in his face.
Get up! Come on. Say hi.
Hi.
Come on, get up.
Jacob sounds meek as a kitten, but by the time he was three, he'd chipped one of his mother's teeth and bloodied her nose a handful of times. It wasn't that he was a bad kid. He was very often sweet. But he had rages. And his mother, Rebecca, who didn't want to use their full names, says these rages could not be controlled.
His temper tantrums, nothing worked. He was the toughest kid. And he couldn't calm down. He couldn't shift his attitude the way other kids can, even if he wanted to.
And Rebecca says Jacob's rages weren't a rare event. They were every day. Anything could trigger them.
My daughter had ballet twice a week, and he hated getting in the car seat to go to ballet, and so he hit me. And he would have furious fits about the car seat. It was just terrible. So it was all the time, all the time.
Rebecca was a single mother raising her two children alone, and her life in those early years felt almost unbearable.
Everyone has lots and lots of advice because, remember, the mommy is the problem every time. It's always the mommy. And many times people who are in my situation get really despondent because they read all the books and they follow all the advice, and it doesn't work. It just doesn't work.
So Rebecca did her best. Prayed her kid would grow out of it. Then, a month into kindergarten, Rebecca got a call from Jacob's school. Jacob had gotten upset.
The teacher tried to hold him, tried to hold both of his arms, and he swung back and hit her in the mouth and busted her lip. I'm talking blood everywhere.
The principal told Rebecca her son couldn't come back, so the next day she stayed home and made appointments. A pediatrician, a psychologist, a psychiatrist. After a round of visits, Jacob was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Bipolar disorder used to be known as manic depression. In adults, it's a disease characterized by episodes of intense highs and lows, periods of mania, periods of depression. It's seen as a lifelong biological problem that can be controlled by medications. So Jacob was put on medications, mood stabilizers, antidepressants. He was 4 years old.
This is your pod. And as you can see, you can decorate it. See?
Today, Jacob is a video game enthusiast who shows me a game called Little Big Planet. Since his diagnosis at 4, he's stayed medicated, and there's absolutely no trace of the angry child his mother describes. Not even Jacob seems to remember him.
I remember a little, but not that much.
Do you ever get angry now?
Very little.
His mom says the same, and according to her, the meds changed Jacob almost immediately, within days.
You know, it was just clear, you know. You said, Jacob, don't do that. He said, okay. He didn't cling on to things the way he did. You could negotiate with him about anything.
The number of kids like Jacob, kids on serious bipolar medications like mood stabilizers, atypical antipsychotics, has grown enormously. In fact, Medicaid spends more money on antipsychotics than it does on any other drug expenditure. Now, many of these kids haven't had the positive experience that Jacob had. But even if they had, David Schaffer, one of the psychiatrists responsible for the changes coming up in the DSM, says that while the medications might be helping kids like Jacob today, we have no idea how they will affect them tomorrow.
In many states you go to, people are worried about the proportion of extremely young children who are receiving atypical antipsychotics, which we think have quite profound effects on important mechanisms in the brain, which may influence growth and development of the nervous system.
You see, almost all of the drugs now used have never been tested in children. So what's happening, critics argue, essentially amounts to an enormous, unregulated experiment directly on American children. And this morning, in a move that could potentially change mental health practice all over America, The American Psychiatric Association announced that it intends to include in its new DSM a diagnosis that it hopes will be used by clinicians instead of the bipolar label. Essentially, they're trying to use the power of the DSM, which is incredibly important because insurance companies use it to decide what to reimburse, to change the behavior of doctors. But Schaffer says that the move shouldn't be misinterpreted.
I don't think anybody is arguing that these are perfectly normal children that get the label. Far from it. We're saying these kids are very sick, but they probably don't have bipolar disorder, and they probably do deserve a name which adequately describes what they're doing.
Child psychiatrist Janet Wozniak helped popularize the bipolar diagnosis for kids. And she says she knows why the diagnosis took off.
The diagnosis took off because it made clinical sense, because we opened our eyes.
But Gabriel Carlson, a child psychiatrist at Stony Brook University, disagrees. She feels the bipolar label took off for a host of other reasons. For example, many of the kids now categorized as bipolar were, once upon a time, she says, diagnosed as having conduct disorder. Kids with conduct disorder are seen as potential juvenile delinquents, aggressive, prone to anger and destructive behavior. But, says Carlson, the treatments for conduct disorder are really pretty limited.
Prayer and fasting. We've got parent kinds of treatment, but the evidence that therapy makes a big difference is not wonderful.
Which is why, says Carlson, when psychiatrists were told that they could now think of this set of behaviors not as conduct disorder, but as manic depression, they got so excited. Because manic depression was treatable with drugs.
Heck, if it's, that's what it is, we've got a bunch of medicines that are supposed to be helpful for mania. If I give it one of these drugs, maybe it'll get better.
Another advantage to bipolar, Carlson points out, is that because the insurance industry saw bipolar as a biological, medical problem, they were happy to fund it. While conduct disorder, a parenting problem, they didn't want to pay for. Finally, Carlson argues, parents themselves were relieved on some level.
Part of the acceptance of the bipolar, if you're a parent, is, hey, I'm off the hook on this one. It's not because I'm a bad parent. I've got a kid with this genetic problem. It's not my fault. And, you know, there's some pros and cons to that. But the fact remains, many people found that liberating.
So clearly, there were some real advantages to using the bipolar label. But the disadvantages, including some of the medications, were so great that David Schaffer told me he and his colleagues on the DSM felt that they had to weigh in and come up with a diagnosis that might be a better fit for kids like Jacob with rage problems.
So what we thought would be valuable would be to carve out a group with the most severe reactions. So ones who, when they do lose their temper, do so with, you know, great force and who are having them frequently, two or three times a week.
The disorder, Schaffer says, will be called temper dysregulation disorder. And it will be seen as a brain or biological dysfunction, but not necessarily as a lifelong condition like bipolar. Of course, there's no way to predict what practical effects these changes might have, how insurance companies, schools might react. For instance, when Rebecca, the mother of Jacob, took paperwork that said that her child was bipolar to the school in her neighborhood, Jacob's violent outburst wasn't seen as evidence that he was a bad seed. He was just sick.
And the school then made plans to immediately take care of the situation. You know, it was, Jacob wasn't suspended from school. He wasn't, you know, he didn't have all those ramifications. It was as if we had discovered he had cancer. You know, he needed accommodations. He needed help. Not a whole lot of craziness.
But, Rebecca was told, if he'd had conduct disorder, he'd probably have to go immediately to a special program. So how will temper dysregulation disorder be seen? Schaffer admits it's hard to say whether doctors will change their behavior and use this new diagnosis. And Gabrielle Carlson says it's possible that even with the new diagnosis, kids will get the same medications.
They may get many of the same, absolutely. Absolutely. But the difference is going to be that you won't have to take it this for the rest of your life.
So, the people at the DSM have spoken. Whether doctors will pay attention remains to be seen. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. It's the fall of 1940. German bombs are pulverizing London, and a young woman named Frankie Bard is on the radio, a Murrow girl, broadcasting the war from Europe. She's alongside screaming British anti-aircraft gunners as they fire shells at waves of German bombers. She's underground with the frightened masses packed into bomb shelters. Frankie Bard is one of the main characters in a new novel by Sarah Blake titled The Postmistress. Edward R. Murrow tells his young protege, "Don't say the streets are rivers of blood. Say that the little policeman I usually say hello to every morning is not there today."
His great power, I think, was that he was able to bring the war home in these tiny human details. And always, it seems, that's how he instructed his reporters, to give the human side of the war, be honest, be neutral, and speak like yourself. And when I read that, that was a very sort of generative piece of information, because Frankie Bard, my character, of course, can't remain neutral. And that, for me, is one of the central questions of the novel, of how is it, especially if you're charged with delivering the news or bearing the news, how do you manage the fact that it's happening right in front of you and that you are implicated in some way or another? And so Frankie, her sort of outrage and her sorrow and her passion come from, I think, the dance that she's trying to dance between neutrality and clear-eyed observation.
I wonder if you can read a section from the book where the narrator is describing how Frankie is processing the changes she's seeing in London during this time, during the Blitz.
"One day, someone you saw every day was there, and the next he was not. This was the only way Frankie had found to report the Blitz. The small policeman on the corner, the grocer with a bad eye, the people you walked to work with, in the shops, on the bus, the people you didn't know but who walked the same route as you, who wove the anonymous fabric of your life. Buildings, gardens, the roof line, one could describe their absence. But for the disappearance of a man, or a little boy, or the woman who used to wait for the bus at the same time as she did, Frankie had found few words. Once they were here, and I saw them."
And Frankie Bard's voice on the radio telling these stories of the people she has seen killed and in front of her eyes in London, that voice goes across the ocean and lands in your book in homes in a tiny town on Cape Cod, coming in through their radios. Mm-hmm. That's the connection.
Mm-hmm. And it's heard there by in this small town, Franklin, Massachusetts, by two other characters who, on the one hand, really don't want to hear the news, but on the other, can't keep themselves from it.
They can't turn her off.
They can't turn her off. And one of them, Iris James, who is the postmistress of the town, who very much prides herself on keeping order in her town by keeping the mail flowing, and she's the keeper of all the secrets, is slightly annoyed by Frankie's broadcast, feeling that maybe she's turning up the pitch too high, that it can't really be as bad as all that. Surely the order will prevail. And the other woman listening is Emma Fitch, who's the newly arrived new wife of the doctor in town. And she listens to Frankie's broadcast with a little bit more personal interest, because early on in the novel, her husband goes to help out in the Blitz.
And he's a doctor.
He is a doctor. He's the town doctor. And she feels very much that the war has robbed her of basically the beginning of her life. So she is certainly not thinking altruistically, but at the same time, and so doesn't want to hear so much how bad it is. At the same time, there's that funny circumstance where she almost listens to the news in case there's any news of Will, which of course there couldn't be, but it's very personal.
Her husband.
Her husband. Mm-hmm.
Many of the stories that Frankie Bard starts telling, she gathers by going on trains that are traveling across Europe bearing Jewish refugees who've been fleeing the pogroms, fleeing the Nazis. And she has with her a portable disc recorder where she's capturing their voices.
Mm-hmm.
Technology that wouldn't have actually existed at the time.
At the time, the technology, the portable disc recorder came into wide use probably 2 years after the time that I set this novel. But for me, so much of the novel is about trying to, you know, asking the question, is it ever possible to tell the whole story? And more, Frankie's trajectory over the course of the novel, having been this brash, intrepid reporter who's going to get the story, she's going to get the story that will turn America's heads, comes to sort of stumble upon the fact that there is no story beyond the single human voices that she's gathering. So she realizes that if she can collect voices, she can then broadcast them, and perhaps that will that really is the story. In there's no narrative. It's just simply, here are these human beings speaking, and they were alive, and they were on this train.
You described it this way, that their stories lay in the edges around what could be told. What do you mean?
I think that this is speaking from myself. When I look at photographs in the newspaper, or when I hear stories on the radio, I am always thinking about what happened in the few seconds immediately after that photograph was taken, the edges after, you know, that is a frame of a single moment. I mean, Martha Gellhorn's quote, Martha Gellhorn, the great war reporter of most of the decades of the 20th century, mm-hmm. She has a quote that starts my book, which is, war happens to people one by one. And I think in some ways the idea of trying to move around the edges of the photograph is really the attempt to get each person and each person's story, not the sort of wide abstraction of war.
It's interesting, though, because the rest of that quote from Martha Gellhorn mm-hmm. is, that is really all I have to say, and it seems to me I've been saying it forever. Mm-hmm. And Frankie Bard, your character, comes across this same sense of despair. She's telling mm-hmm. these stories, and she can tell, or she thinks, that no one is listening. They're not resonating back home in any tangible way.
That's
Nothing's
right.
being done for the
That's
Jewish
right.
refugees.
That's right. And one of the things that, the more I researched the war reporting of the time, I mean, there was, it seems to me, enormous disconnect between the reporters who were in Europe, who could clearly see what was going on, and the way in which it was either allowed to be reported or the way in which it ended up landing in the newspaper. The story of what was going on for the Jews was always embedded in the middle of papers. It was never a kind of front page story for a long, long time. And Frankie, at one point, sort of quotes Martha Gellhorn, saying that Martha Gellhorn had said, we belong to a federation of Cassandras. And that really seemed to me, over and over, the kind of despair and worry of the reporters that were there in the late 30s and early 40s, before it was the good war. That's the thing. Nobody could really knew where it was going. Nobody knew the ending.
Sarah Blake, her new novel is titled The Postmistress. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
For those of us living in Washington this past week, we have found ourselves running out of words to describe the endless snow that's blanketed the city. It seems epic, at least to those of us in this part of the country, more the stuff of literature and legend than real life. And while so many of us are still trudging through back-to-back blizzards, we thought we could find comfort in looking to literature, where the snow doesn't have to be plowed or shoveled. It just has to be enjoyed. In the hands of a good storyteller, snow can be magical or monstrous. How many of us remember Laura Ingalls Wilder's terrifying description in her novel, The Long Winter? It's based on her own childhood growing up on the prairie.
Laura felt they were going in the wrong direction. She did not know why she felt so. No one could see anything. There was nothing to go by. No sun, no sky, no direction. The winds blowing fiercely from all directions. There was nothing but the dizzy whirling and the cold. It seemed that the cold and the winds and the noise of the winds and the blinding, smothering, scratching snow and the effort and the aching were forever. Pa had lived through 3 days of a blizzard under the bank of Plum Creek, but there were no creek banks here. Here there was nothing but bare prairies. Pa had told about sheep caught in a blizzard, huddled together under the snow. Some of them had lived. Perhaps people could do that too.
In the hands of writers, really good writers, snow can be in soft focus or sharply crystallized, as it is in the description from this best-selling thriller, Smell a Sense of Snow, by the Danish writer Peter Hoag.
At first, the snow is six-sided, newly formed flakes. After 48 hours, the flakes break down, their outlines blur. By the 10th day, the snow is a grainy crystal that becomes compacted after 2 months. After 2 years, it enters the transitional stage between snow and fern. After 4 years, it's transformed into a large, blocky, glacial crystal. It wouldn't survive more than 3 years here on Gela Alta. By that time, the glacier would push it out to sea. There, it would break up and float outward to melt, disperse, and be absorbed by the sea. And then someday, it would rise up as newly formed snow. You can't win against the ice.
In the classic novel Native Son by Richard Wright, snow serves as a metaphor for Bigger Thomas's mounting troubles and the ugliness of his plight.
He walked to Dalton's through the snow. His right hand was in his coat pocket, his fingers about the kidnap note. When he reached the driveway, he looked about the street carefully. There was no one. He looked at the house. It was huge, white, silent. He walked up the steps and stood in front of the door. He waited a moment to see what would happen. So deeply conscious was he of violating a dangerous taboo that he felt the very air or sky would suddenly speak, commanding him to stop. He was sailing fast in the face of a cold wind that all but sucked his breath from him. But he liked it. Around him were silence and night and snow falling, falling as though it had fallen from the beginning of time and would always fall till the end of the world.
And finally, sometimes literary snow is simply beautiful, hauntingly beautiful. Here's Robert Frost reading from his classic Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening.
Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near between the woods and frozen lake the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds, the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep. And miles to go before I sleep.
This is NPR.
As we reported yesterday, the American Psychiatric Association has proposed eliminating the diagnosis of Asperger's disorder. Children with this diagnosis are often highly intelligent, but they can have social problems that make it hard to thrive in school. The new definition would place kids within an expanded definition of autism. And these words matter. They matter a lot when it's a label you're putting on your kid. The change could affect families trying to get special education services in the public schools, as NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
Parents of children with autism turn to the federal law that guarantees a free public education for students with disabilities. Kids with autism clearly qualify. For kids with Asperger's, it's been much less clear, especially in California. Melinda Bird, senior counsel with the advocacy group Disability Rights California, says the current guidelines used by psychiatrists present parents with a confusing set of symptoms.
And so parents in school districts spend unnecessary time arguing about whether a child meets every one of these nuanced criteria.
Bird says California school districts regularly question whether kids with Asperger's disorder need special ed services because they are often very verbal and very sharp. The new proposed guidelines could ease that confusion by eliminating Asperger's, as well as the unfortunately named pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified. That change may make it easier to get services and could speed up what has become a lengthy process. Melinda Bird says that's good for both parents and school districts.
Who will no longer have to try and slice and dice a child up into these different eligibility categories, and everyone will be able to get on about the business of educating children in need.
But special education is seldom that simple. Many attorneys say getting kids recognized as eligible for services is not their biggest challenge. It's getting the services that families actually want, whether it's tutoring or placement in a special school. Steven Greenberg, a special ed attorney in Northern California, says with or without the Asperger's category, schools draw a line in the sand.
Schools often balk at private placements, at having to pay for a placement outside of public school.
Because private placements can cost districts tens of thousands of dollars a year per student. Greenberg says the issue boils down to whether parents in an individual case are happy with what schools offer.
What do you do with that diagnosis and the eligibility? Does the child stay in the public school? Should they be disciplined as other students who do not have the disorder?
An important question, since disabled students have protections against being expelled when they act out. Educators who work with these students say they're concerned about the end of Asperger's for another reason. They feel they're losing a valuable tool which signaled what these kids need. Danya Jekyll runs the Asperger's Association of New England.
It sort of lets the teachers know, the professionals know, that there are a particular set of supports that are needed for these children.
Like other professionals, many educators say they've become accustomed to the Asperger's label. They're concerned the new category could just complicate things for kids who already face a lot of challenges. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
And now to New York and two reports on Governor David Paterson. He's fighting unspecified allegations of personal misconduct rumored to be contained in an article in the New York Times. But that article has not yet been published, and it may not involve any such allegations. Nonetheless, NPR's David Folkenflik reports that Paterson now faces a mounting media frenzy.
In a press conference yesterday, Governor Paterson had a few choice words for what he had been hearing.
False allegations, unsubstantiated rumors, and in some cases, straight-out lies.
Bloggers, politicians, and lobbyists had been abuzz about Paterson's personal behavior, yet the governor said he sat down for an extensive interview with reporter Danny Hakim of the New York Times that touched on nothing of the sort.
The article will be written about other subjects, and not the ones that have been the source of the mass speculation and feeding frenzy and circus that we have witnessed the last couple of weeks.
This truly is the scandal that dare not say its name, because nobody really knows what the heck it is. Rex Smith is editor of the Albany Times Union.
It is crazy. It's a media environment like I've never seen before.
His paper has reported gingerly on the effect the rumors are having on Paterson.
I've been in Albany for more than 20 years, used to cover state government for Newsday. I can't believe what I'm seeing.
There have been rumors about politicians ever since the first politicians. But the lightning pace of the online news cycle, combined with the media's obsession with itself, has led to the transformation of ethereal rumor into something quite tangible. On taking office, Paterson admitted earlier marital infidelity and cocaine use. In January, the New York Post suggestively reported Paterson had been seen lunching with a woman not his wife in New Jersey. No real scandal ensued. Another suggestive item in the Post sparked the interest of the New York Daily News. Reporter Elizabeth Benjamin blogged that the rumor mill about Paterson's personal conduct was running overtime, and she said a major publication had a bombshell. Then John Koblin, who writes about media for the New York Observer, wrote this on Twitter. Anyone hearing about NYT bombshell on Paterson? Heard big damaging story coming.
If he's saying that he hears this, then, you know, I think that's a credible source as far as what's being passed on the grapevine.
Gabriel Snyder is editor of Gawker, the influential online gossip and news site. Snyder had Gawker post on Paterson after reading the Koblin tweet. Snyder says rumors themselves can be noteworthy.
It starts to become almost dishonest to talk about the governor of a state and not mention that the entire political class is speculating that there is some sex rumor that's going to come out that's going to cause him to resign.
Yet Koblin was just echoing the Daily News, not doing any original reporting. No matter. The web exploded. On Sunday, Business Insider cited a single anonymous source to report the Times would likely be publishing its bombshell on Monday and that Paterson would resign soon. Neither happened, but the tabloids gave his denials front-page treatment, and by Tuesday, Paterson was angry at the New York Times. He asked Times editors to announce they weren't pursuing any personal peccadilloes.
They don't seem to be interested in addressing it or doing anything about it, and I think it's appalling.
Rex Smith of the Times Union says the story should have been published several days ago because the speculation is causing such harm.
It seems to me that this is one of those circumstances where the news medium is itself feeding into the story, and I think the Times ought to publish.
Times spokeswoman Diane McNulty said the paper is not responsible for what others write. The story is expected soon. At least, that's according to the rumor mill. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.